From West Virginia Public Broadcasting.
Support for the legislature today is provided by the following.
AARP West Virginia, your ally for real possibilities in the Mountain State. Online at aarp.org/WV. West Virginia Higher Education Policy Commission, working to double the degrees produced annually to meet workforce demands and grow West Virginia's economy. Learn more at wvhepc.edu. The W. Page Pitt School of Journalism and Mass Communications at Marshall University, providing hands-on education in advertising, public relations, and journalism across all media platforms.
At the legislature today, delegates are considering a bill that changes the way lawmakers report political donations during the legislative session. A national report says West Virginia's roads and bridges are deteriorating and costing taxpayers dearly. And the House and Senate minority leaders join us to discuss their view of the governor's budget plan. Those stories coming up on the legislature today. Good evening, I'm Ashton Mara. The Republican majority in the Senate is starting to reveal its plan to restructure the state's tax code. A bill introduced in that chamber today would repeal the state's income and corporate net income taxes and replace them with a higher consumer sales tax and fewer exemptions. Governor Justice, of course, has already released his proposal to balance the state budget on tax increases and a small amount of cuts. Joining me this evening to share their ideas about what to do with the state budget this session are Delegate Tim Miley from Harrison County. He's the minority leader in the House of Delegates. And from Marion County, Senator Roman Prezioso, the Senate minority leader. Gentlemen, thank you so much for being here this evening.
Thank you for having us, Ashton.
Thank you.
So let's start with this Republican bill in the Senate, Senate Bill 335. Now, it's a 54-page bill, just got introduced today, yeah. So I know you guys haven't dug into the details very deep, but overall, raises the sales tax to 8%, gets rid of a lot of exemptions, and it phases out the personal income tax by 2021, phases out the corporate net income tax. Senator, do you have concerns about the math here?
Well, yes, I do. You know, it sounds good. We'd certainly like to eliminate the personal income tax. We've already got a 6% sales tax. Raising it to 8% just doesn't add up when you look at the figures. So we're anxious to get through the bill, see where the exemptions are, see how they're going to approach it. And, you know, we're willing to work with them. And if we can find a way to make this work, that's fine, but the details in the numbers.
So, Senator, you're the former finance chair in the chamber. When we talk about getting rid of the personal income tax, how much money is that each year?
The personal income tax in the fiscal year that we're going to work on, the FY18, is about $1.8 billion, and that's our biggest revenue-generating line item. So, subsequently, it would seem to me if you're going to replace that, that's going to take about a 9-cent increase in the consumer sales tax in addition to the 6% that you already have. But when you throw in the exemptions and some of the other factors that we haven't seen yet, that's what we have to look at. So right now at face value, it's going to be hard for me to comprehend how we're going to get to, you know, a zero base and a zero net, but we're willing to engage.
Delegate, generally, in terms of policy, phasing out income tax and replacing it with a consumer sales tax, how do you feel about that?
I'm not particularly fond of it, Ashton. I think when you phase out the income tax, that clearly benefits the high wage earners because they're the ones who pay the most tax, which in theory sounds good. I mean, who really wants to pay a lot of tax? But if you're talking about getting rid of the personal income tax, it's not much of a sacrifice for the low wage earners because they're not paying that much. But yet, when you get rid of the personal income tax and increase taxes over here on goods and services that everyone, including low-wage earners, have to pay, it has a disproportionate impact on their lives, much more so than it does the high-wage earners. So I don't like it generally, and I don't think the numbers add up. And part of what I understand that plan to be is eliminating all exemptions on the sales tax while raising it to 8%. But one of those areas of exemptions that I understand is being considered is removing the exemptions on medical services. So in other words, while you don't have to pay sales taxes on medical services now, under this plan, as I understand it, you will have to pay sales taxes on medical services provided to you. I tend to think that's a little bit immoral. I mean, if you're getting medical services, it's because you have medical problems, and to lay taxes on top of what you're going to have to pay anyway, I think is unreasonable for the citizens of this state.
So you see this as shifting the burden to low-income West Virginians?
Well, it clearly shifts the burden to consumers. I mean, when we're talking about getting rid of the personal income tax and phasing out the corporate net income tax and shifting it on to a sales tax, then it's consumers who pay that. And I clearly think it's shifting the burden from the corporate wage earners to the average West Virginian. And I don't think that's fair.
Well, let's talk about the governor's plan then a little bit. He relies on cutting about $26 million out of the budget and increasing taxes by $450 million. It comes from a half a cent increase on the consumer sales tax, 0.2 of a cent on a state, basically a state B&O tax, right, some other things. How do you feel about the governor's plan, Senator?
Well, I think the governor's plan is a systemic approach to balancing the budget, putting the burden on business and industry and the consumers. And to do that is a fair way to do it. You can't expect the consumer to pay the whole freight of the bill. And, you know, he's left the option open that we can work with him if we know additional cuts. You know, he would be willing to look at that. I know there's some concern about, you know, the consumer activity tax, which is a B&O tax, which everyone would pay. So we would look at more of a corporate net where those people that would make profits would pay on that aspect of it. So, you know, he's left the door open. He's willing to negotiate, but he's a businessman and he had a plan. And as he said, the patient is on the operating table. We can't afford to cut him anymore. We've got to build and put it back together, and we have to do that in the state. We have to build the economy so it grows.
Delegate, how likely is a plan like this to get through your chamber?
I don't know. It's going to be very difficult because many in the Republican majority have said they don't want any tax increases. They just want to make all cuts. So I don't know the numbers yet. I did meet with the Speaker Armstead yesterday to find out where each of our relative caucuses were. And we just talked in generalities, but it's going to be hard to get any budget passed, I can assure you, because we're going to have to cobble together some members of both caucuses who are willing to stand for cuts as well as tax increases. And no one really likes doing either.
Well, both the Senate President and the House Speaker have said they want to eliminate exemptions and the consumer sales tax. The governor has put that into his proposal as well. But, Delegate, do you think that the Republican majority in the House needs the Democratic vote to do that?
I think ultimately they will need the Democratic caucus or certain members of the Democratic caucus to help pass a budget, because there are many members in the Republican majority who are not going to want to make the severe cuts that would otherwise have to be made to balance the budget. And there, at the same time, there are many members within that Republican caucus that don't want any tax increases whatsoever. So I think they're going to have to get some members of the Democratic caucus together with some from the Republican caucus to pass a budget. And whether that can be done, I don't know yet, because we've seen the governor's plan, which we are generally supportive of in concept, but we've seen no plan yet from the Republicans in the House of Delegates anyway. And until we see their plan, we really can't offer an opinion as to whether anybody in the Democratic caucus will support it.
Now, Senator, the finance chairs of both chambers, were on the show last night. And Senator Hall, the finance chairman in the Senate, said he's going to start splitting his committee up into subcommittees. And you're on the finance committee.
That's correct. Did that today. We did that today. We broke into four subcommittees. We're going to break down the budgets in those particular areas and take a look and see if there are additional savings, additional cuts that we can make, or actually see if we need to increase some budgets. So I think we're approaching it in a fair and systematic way, and the Democrats on the Senate side are certainly willing to work with the majority party.
Is there much room left to cut?
In my estimation, there isn't. When you look at the budget, three-fourths of that budget's in code. It's public education. So if you take a $4 billion budget and you've got $1 billion to work with, They want to, you know, you want to cut it in half. It's almost impossible to do. There has to be some general revenue enhancements.
Delegate, we've got less than a minute left, but I'll give you the last word. What do you hope to see from this budget plan?
The governor's budget plan?
From the plan that you all end up with at the end of this session, what do you hope it looks like?
Well, I hope it looks like one that enhances revenue so that we can continue providing the services that we currently do as a state, because many families will be affected. I think it sends a bad message if we cut so much from our state services, including our educational system, that we're going to be repelling people away from our state instead of drawing them in. And the governor is very determined to make sure that we fix our problems completely and not have any half measures, because half measures won't get us there. Half measures won't create an appealing place for people to come and visit and create jobs and bring their families here and go to school.
Delegate Tim Miley and Senator Roman Prezioso, minority leaders, thank you so much.
Thank you, Ashton.
A national research group says the deficiencies, congestion, and lack of safety features on West Virginia's roadways are costing drivers more than $1 billion each year. Governor Jim Justice plans to change that by drastically increasing funding for construction and maintenance through a road bond. But members of the Senate have mixed feelings about whether that plan can succeed.
The report is alarming. This is terrible news.
Tom Smith is Governor Jim Justice's newly appointed Secretary of the Department of Transportation. His alarm comes from a report released Thursday at the Capitol by TRIP, a national transportation research group based in D.C. The report says each year, West Virginia drivers pay an additional $1.4 billion in vehicle maintenance, the cost of traffic accidents, and wasted gasoline and time because of the poor condition of the state's roads. TRIP's executive director, Will Wilkins, says that averages out to more than $1,000 per West Virginian per year. The report didn't come as a surprise to the few members of the legislature who attended the press conference, but Secretary Smith says it's one more reminder that the state needs to change its funding structure.
And if you look at the numbers over several years, you see this continued slippage. It really makes the point I think the Governor Justice has asked us to look at in transportation, that the longer we go, the behinder we get. And we really can't afford to not invest in infrastructure.
Governor Jim Justice presented his plan to fix the state's roads during his State of the State address last week. His plan includes increasing the gasoline tax by 10 cents, raising the fees drivers pay at the Division of Motor Vehicles, and hiking the price of tolls on the turnpike by $1 to create a revenue stream to bond. That bond, which he estimates could be as large as $2.8 billion, will drastically improve the state's economy, according to the new governor.
I'll tell you what it'll do. It'll create 48,000 jobs in our state. 48,000 jobs. It'll complete the network that we have got to do. It will make tourism explode in this state. Honest to Pete.
Democratic Senator Bob Beach knows a thing or two about the inadequacies of the state's roadways. From Monongalia County, the senator says his constituents in Morgantown deal with congestion on a daily basis, and those in the more rural areas struggle with the lack of maintenance. Beach says passage of the governor's proposal, raising the gasoline tax, increasing DMV fees and hiking tolls, will allow West Virginia to focus the money it already has on maintaining roads instead of splitting it with the cost of new construction. That benefits the West Virginians that the TRIP report says are already paying extra as a result of poor road conditions, Beach says.
My perspective is, if we get this package, the governor's proposal package, passed in its entirety, that allows us to take that fund that we have in place right now that we're trying to do everything with, trying to build new roads and repair them and just general maintenance, that allows us to take that entire fund and focus on the little county routes we have across the state. And we have a lot of them, 36,000 miles of them.
Senate Transportation Chair Greg Boso says parts of the governor's package appeal to him. He'd like to keep the tolls on the state turnpike and could even agree to raise those tolls if West Virginians are not asked to pay the higher fee. But the other pieces of the proposal, like the gasoline tax, he's less sure about.
We've got to be cautious about that. Why? Because we've got a number of people in the local home communities where they struggle every year, every day, just to make enough money to put gas in the gas tank so they can get to work and do the things they need to do.
But Mon County Senator Beach says his fellow lawmakers don't have to vote to increase those taxes and fees. They have to vote to allow a bond proposal to be placed on the ballot during the next election.
We're taking that to the consumer. We're allowing the voters to have make a decision in the ultimate outcome of this.
TRIP, the group that wrote the report on West Virginia's roadways, receives funding from manufacturing, labor, construction, and engineering groups from across the country. They were invited to Charleston to present their latest report by the Contractors Association of West Virginia, a lobbying group that works to promote the interests of the construction industry in the state. Although the budget is lawmakers' top priority, members of both the House and Senate are continuing to work on other pieces of legislation as well. In the House, those include bills to strengthen criminal penalties and create more transparency in the election process. Liz McCormick has more.
On second reading in the House today, lawmakers looked at House Bill 2099. The bill would make it a felony if someone flees the scene of a car crash when serious bodily harm or death has occurred. Delegate Pat McGeehan is a Republican from Hancock County. He says he decided to sponsor the bill this year after being approached by a constituent who experienced an accident himself.
I had a constituent that was a victim of a hit and run about 3 years ago, and unfortunately, he lost his leg. He had to have his leg amputated after the hit and run. He was hit by a heavy truck, and the driver chose to flee the scene of the accident.
In West Virginia currently, fleeing the scene of an accident after someone has been seriously injured is only a misdemeanor. McGeehan says that posed a real problem for his constituent.
We later found out the county prosecutor really had no legal authority to go after the perpetrator. Because it was only considered a misdemeanor at the time, even though my constituent lost his leg and almost lost his life. So it was important to try to correct that problem with West Virginia law.
The bill will be up for a final vote by the chamber tomorrow.
Another bill being considered by the House would bring more transparency to the state's election process, according to its lead sponsor. The bill focuses specifically on legislative fundraising.
Bill 2319 would require candidates running for legislative offices or their candidate committees to disclose any fundraising they may do during the legislative session to the Secretary of State's office within 5 days of the fundraising event. Delegate Jill Upson, a Republican from Jefferson County, is the lead sponsor of the bill.
Constituents, they want to know what we're doing. They want to know who's influencing us. And so even though receiving contributions during the session isn't illegal, people just ought to know who we're receiving money from.
Upson says it's not an issue she's seen among her legislative colleagues, but it's a law she feels ought to be on the books.
I just think that transparency is important. I mean, we do have an issue with people saying that they just don't trust their representatives, and so this is just one way to rebuild that trust.
House Bill 2319 will be on second reading tomorrow and eligible for amendments. For the legislature today, I'm Liz McCormick in the House.
Tonight we go to Wetzel and Tyler counties, where we meet three more members of the West Virginia Legislature in this edition of Meet Your Lawmakers.
Charles Clements is a Republican from Wetzel County. He was appointed by Governor Jim Justice in January to fill a seat left vacant by Agricultural Commissioner Kent Leonhardt. Clements represents the 2nd Senatorial District and is a former member of the State House of Delegates. As Executive Director of the West Virginia Route 2 and Interstate 68 Authority, Senator Clements also served as a member of Governor Justice's Transportation Policy Transition Team. David Pethel is a Democrat from Wetzel County. He was first elected to the West Virginia House of Delegates in 1988 and served until 1992. He was elected again to represent the state's 5th House District in 1998. Pethel is a retired teacher. William Roger Romine is from Tyler County and represents the state's 6th House of Delegates district. A Republican, Romine was elected in 2000. He is the vice chairman of the House Committee on Agriculture. Delegate Romine is a retired school administrator.
The state capitol is full of people with a wide range of jobs. There are police officers and bill writers, custodians and tax analysts. And some of those employees even bring a little something extra to the table. Dennis Loudermilk is the West Virginia legislature's web engineer, but in his spare time, he's a woodworker. His hobby has gotten the attention of some of the top legislative leaders at the State House over the past 10 years, giving him the opportunity to create several pieces of history. Liz McCormick reports.
Although low-tech, a gavel is a pretty important piece of equipment for a House Speaker or a Senate President. Its sound is used to mark the beginning or end of a chamber floor session, or sometimes it's used to bring our lawmakers back to order during a heated debate. This legislative session, Senator Mitch Carmichael, a Republican from Jackson County, took over the role of Senate President. That new position means Carmichael needed a gavel of his own. That's where Dennis Loudermilk comes in. At the Capitol, Loudermilk is the legislature's web engineer. He takes care of the website and manages the audio and video broadcasts of floor sessions and committee meetings. But in the basement of his home, just outside of Charleston, he's a woodworker.
Well, my dad taught me woodworking probably from the time I was six on through high school. Shop classes and did a lot with my dad. He taught me woodworking through the years. And here we are today, just continued. It was just something I like to do.
Dennis says it was his father who ignited his passion for woodworking, and he taught him how to make a variety of things, from lamps, candle holders, bowls, and even rocking chairs. He says he was always excited to work with his dad.
He actually built our first lathe when I was about probably five or six.
Now, what is that?
This is a lathe. It's not the one he built. I still have it, but this is a little better one, a little newer. This is what takes square shapes of wood and makes it round.
Dennis has worked in some form of IT on the Capitol grounds for more than 30 years, but only in the last 20 years has he worked for the legislature. It was then that his hobby became known to his colleagues and lawmakers. In 2007, Democrat Rick Thompson was elected as Speaker of the House. That was the first time Dennis was asked to make a gavel for a legislator. He was approached by then House Clerk Greg Gray.
Greg Gray, I think, called me and said he'd like to talk to him. He called me up to his office and said he and Mrs. Thompson would like to talk to me because somehow they knew I did woodwork. So when I went in and at the prescribed time, I went up there, and he and Rick Thompson's wife then approached me about she wanted to buy him his first gavel. So it was very moving. I was honored to do it.
Since, Dennis has crafted 10 gavels for legislative leaders. He says because they're handmade, each gavel is unique.
And there's no two gavels, they're not even close. This is a gavel I made just as a test piece. You can see different colors in the wood. This has maple pieces glued onto walnut. And every gavel is made from multiple pieces. Usually a minimum of 9 pieces go in the head of the gavel.
That's in addition, Dennis says, to the 1 or 2 pieces of wood that make the handle. After he finishes gluing the various pieces together, he uses his lathe to help shape it. In all, the process takes 4 or 5 days. After the woodworking is complete, Dennis then customizes both the gavel and the sounding block, or the chunk of wood the gavel hits to make that loud, resonating sound. For Carmichael, Dennis will include the Senate seal on the gavel and has special plans for the sounding block as well, a round shape.
It's never been round before, it's always been square. But this year we're going to make it round. We're going to incorporate some of the Senate pins in that round shape. And we will either burn wood with wood burning or put a little brass emblem on it with maybe his initials and a date or something on it like that.
Dennis says he never expected his passion for woodworking would overlap with his job at the Capitol.
I came down here in the basement and built this shop after we moved into this house. I turned this area into the shop and it was just my R&R time that I came down here to get away from the world. I never thought it would ever become anything, that anybody wanted.
Senate President Carmichael was presented his brand new gavel on the first day of the 2017 legislative session in January. It's the 11th Dennis has crafted in his time working for the legislature, but he says he certainly hopes it's not his last. For the Legislature Today, I'm Liz McCormick.
Tomorrow on our show, we wrap up this first full week of the legislative session with a roundtable discussion focused on that all-important budget bill. This has been the Legislature Today. I'm Ashton Mara. Thanks for joining us.
Support for the Legislature Today is provided by the following.
AARP West Virginia, your ally for real possibilities in the Mountain State. Online at aarp.org/WV. West Virginia Higher Education Policy Commission, working to double the degrees produced annually to meet workforce demands and grow West Virginia's economy. Learn more at wvhepc.edu. The W. Page Pitt School of Journalism and Mass Communications at Marshall University, providing hands-on education in advertising, public relations, and journalism across all media platforms. From West Virginia Public Broadcasting.